You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, so grab your drink of choice, settle into a comfy chair. If you're driving, pull over because we've got a great guest. Our next guest talks with all kinds of leaders from all walks of our lives, the household names, the execs, the innovators, the warriors, the upstarts, the artists. And from those conversations, he has written a trilogy of books, How to Lead on Leadership, The Second the American Story. It was all about the American history. And the book's title, The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream, is his third book in this series. So it's great to have joining us David Rubenstein. He is host of Bloomberg Wealth on Bloomberg TV and Bloomberg Radio. And of course, you know him as co-founder and co-chair of the private equity firm, The Carlyle Group. He joins us in our Interactive Broker Studio. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's really wonderful. And I feel like you are someone who talks with so many different people, different points of view. We were wondering about the last couple of years with everything going on, how that kind of has shaped who you want to talk to and how you were thinking about this book, The American Experiment.
Well, generally, I like to talk to people who are willing to say something. As you know, from being an interviewer, if you watch the Sunday talk shows, sometimes you say, why do these people go on these shows? Because they don't really want to say anything. What you want is somebody who's willing to say something and say something they haven't said before. That's the best interview, right? And so I'm always looking for somebody who is willing to be engaging and doesn't want to just spar with the interviewer and not say anything. So, you know, it's a challenge, but that's what I'm trying to do. And you always want somebody that people will listen to and want to hear. So if I got an engaging guest, but nobody's ever heard of that person, it may not be as effective. If you can get Jeff Bezos, you know that's what people want to hear from him. So
Right. So
you want somebody who has a name and who's willing to engage. And some people are great and some people are not as great. And, you know, you just figure it out during the interview.
But we think about what's happened with the pandemic, the Capitol riots, the inequities, George Floyd. We could go on and on. It feels like a decade or two decades of history have happened in the last year and a half. How has that, David, shaped kind of your thinking and putting this book together? And again, the voices you wanted to get to.
Well, each one has a different thing. Take the January 6th event. I do talk about it extensively in the book. And I basically say, it was a severe stress test for America, and America won. And I dedicate the book to the public servants who protect our democracy, because remember, we had 65 lawsuits that were filed to overturn the election, and none of them actually prevailed. None of them got very far. All the judges basically complied with what is the rule of law, and they basically didn't act political. So I think we learned a lot about the importance of the rule of law in this country. We also learned a lot in terms of the importance of healthcare in this country, how it's so unfair that people are of minority status or are poor really were suffering disproportionately because of COVID, because they don't have good healthcare to begin with,
right,
and they didn't have access to the best healthcare. And it's a sad situation. But it also made me think about this, my mortality. I'm 72 years old. And when you're 72, you had a chance of, you got this disease, that you could maybe not survive. And we now know that 65% of the people who went on ventilators didn't actually come back out of the ventilators. We were putting people on ventilators thinking it was helping. It wasn't. So we learned a lot about how to treat people. But suppose I had gotten this and I went on a ventilator, I probably wouldn't be here now. So I learned a lot about my mortality and thinking about it. And the result is I'm rushing to get more things done because I now realize, hey, life is very short and something bad could happen very quickly. And so that's been something that I've been thinking a lot about.
It's like the Hamilton, right? I'm running out of time.
Right.
That whole concept.
Well, as you point out in the book, the American experiment has been relatively short at this point. And I'm wondering if you could contextualize the way that you think about what happened over the last year and a half, as to what extent it really stress tested us. Because you do make note of the judiciary essentially saving the United States, not the lawmakers. Because you do call out in the book the lawmakers, the senators and the members of Congress who voted to overturn the election. They are still in power right now.
Yes, and I know many of them. And privately, they will say to you, well, I had to do that, or I knew it wasn't going to really prevail. Sure, but many of these people are, you know, I live in Washington. I host a series in front of members of Congress once a month. With COVID ending soon, hopefully I'll be resuming that. And I know a lot of members and so forth. And, you know, privately what they say is, well, I had to do this, and they didn't really believe in it, but, you know, and so forth. Some will say that. I'm not going to go say who said that. But clearly, it's a very political situation. It's just the saddest part of the whole situation we now face is that we've politicized the government so much so that the country's really unable to move forward very much. We have people who don't want to wear masks, who think that it's a good thing to force people not to wear masks, in effect. We you know, it's a sad situation in many ways when you think about it, that school children whose teachers want them to have masks are being told they aren't supposed to have that mask. So a bad situation, and people are dying because of this.
When did debate become like a bad thing? I thought that was what kind of the roots of democracy were all about, this whole idea of having different perspectives and hopefully talking it through and getting to a better place.
When I worked in Congress in the 1970s and in the White House, there were obviously political disputes all the time, and obviously this was after Watergate, but people thought eventually you got to get something done, and so you had bipartisan legislation. Now, if to be considered a great legislator, used to be you were good at bipartisan legislation, get people on both sides to work together. Now, to be a great legislator, you're probably somebody that is good in only getting your Democrats or your Republicans to support you. And members of Congress now spend so much time raising money because they want to raise money for their campaigns or to thwart anybody from challenging them. And they have to spend 40% of their time, in the case of members of the House, to raising money. And the money and the internet and social media has just divided the country in so many ways that I find it interesting when I host these dinners, many people say this is the most interesting thing that members feel they're doing in Washington. They can have a dinner when nobody sees they're meeting with somebody from the opposite party because there's no press there, and they can talk to people from the opposite house, which they rarely do because they rarely have conference committees anymore. It's, look, I also recognize this. Every generation, 10,000 years back and so forth, has always said, well, in my time it was better, and now it's not as good. Now, George Washington's father allegedly told him, well, your generation is not going to achieve anything because you guys are not hardworking or whatever. Well, the truth is every generation tells the younger people you're not going to be tough enough, you're not going to be surviving enough, and ultimately civilization goes forward. So sure, there are challenges now. I'm not happy with many things that have happened. One thing that did happen, though, during all this period of time is the George Floyd murder. In that case, the thing that struck me was this. We've been through, I lived through the Civil Rights Revolution. We've lived through the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and so many things that have been done, affirmative action, other things. But this one murder crystallized for people in this country the fact that we are still discriminating in so many ways. Just think about it. All the people that have been lynched over the years didn't seem to have the same resonance as this one murder. Maybe because it was on TV, maybe everybody saw it, maybe because people saw it was so ridiculous the way it was handled. But we've made some progress, obviously, on racial relations. And I'd say in the book that while we've made a lot of progress on racial relations and gender equality and other things, we still have a long way to go. The rhetoric that is in the Declaration of Independence and the rhetoric in the Constitution is wonderful. Well, we've been spending 230 years trying to live up to that rhetoric. And to some extent, we've made progress, and to some extent, we haven't. And what I say in the book is that we have these genes. These genes are part of us, the belief in the rule of law, the belief in equality, the belief in the power of voting. And we've been trying to make sure that people kind of honor these things that are part of our genes, and sometimes we do and sometimes we don't. The rule of law is a gene that's so strong that it prevailed in the January 6th situation and the post-election fight, and I think that was good. In many other countries, had you had a leader do what was done here, I think you could have had a military takeover.
Yeah, it could have been much closer. I wonder, David, about this sense of optimism that you have potentially after writing a book like this. I do think there is this collective despair over the last 18, 19 months as this pandemic has played out and we try to get to the other side of it. And here we are sandwiched between extreme weather events, you know, that are affecting the entire country, whether it's drought or hurricane or fires, trying to get our kids back to school. After writing this book and speaking to these people and looking so closely at the history of the United States, are you optimistic?
I think most people who are asked that question will say yes, because nobody wants to say, no, I'm pessimistic. It sounds bad to say I'm pessimistic, and I'd be lying if I said I was pessimistic. It might make news to say I'm pessimistic. I am optimistic about many things. The young people are so creative. We are solving some problems like global climate change. We're working on some things. Racial relations are getting better. They're not perfect. But if you weren't optimistic, it'd be hard to get through life. If every day you were so depressed you couldn't get through life, you know, what would you do? So I'm optimistic, and I've had been fortunate in my life to be able to be optimistic because of good things that have happened to me. But generally, I'm reasonably optimistic. I'm just worried about some things that we could solve that we don't seem to be solving as quickly as I wish we would.
Let's talk about some of the conversations. Ken Burns, Madeleine Albright, Jill Lepore, who I don't know is necessarily a household name, Walter Isaacson, David McCullough, some of the things, Rita Moreno, some of the conversations that stood out. And obviously, they talked about very different topics.
the different topics.
But a common thread, I guess.
Well, Ken Burns talked about Vietnam, and it turns out in Vietnam, the political leaders knew all along. They knew all along that we had no chance of winning that war militarily. It was really a political exercise, which was disappointing because we lost 58,000 men and the Vietnamese lost millions of people. David McCullough did a wonderful job of explaining how nobody took the Wright brothers seriously in this country. They had to go to France to kind of prove that they could fly.
Another reason why we love France.
Right. You know, so Rita Moreno is an incredible story, and a woman from Puerto Rico who was not taken that seriously as an actress because she was from Puerto Rico. She was given kind of Latina jobs, but she turned out to be an Academy Award winner, and she had an interesting life. She lived with a very famous person for quite some time, Marlon Brando, and I think 8 years or so, and then tried to commit suicide because he was unfaithful, and then she recovered from that and obviously went on to now win an Emmy, a Grammy, every other award, Tony, that you can win. So she's quite an impressive person now, still performing at age 88 or 89.
She was at our Boston Pops event, and she's a Spitfire. Got to meet her, and she's unbelievable in terms of her energy. You also talked with Walter Isaacson, and I think innovation is something we spend a lot of time here talking about around the table. And, you know, that governments, the complicated relationship, really, between governments and innovation, we're seeing it once again. What did you glean from that conversation?
Walter points out in his book, really a focus on the innovators, a book right before the Codebreakers. Codebreakers, a new book about a woman that won the Nobel Prize for, in effect, discovering CRISPR. And that's a great book as well. Mm-hmm. But the innovators is about all the people that have changed our lives, who invented the microprocessor, the transistor, the smartphone, the internet, all the things. How could we live today without the internet? How could we live today without smartphones, all these things? But now these all came about because of smart people doing things that people said couldn't be done, and typically as part of teams. There are very few geniuses that are discovering things by themselves. He points out usually it's a person working with somebody else, and usually they're building on something that somebody else actually did before them. But the most important thing is our country has been a country where we've been strong because of innovation. We are the country that innovates. We're reinventing ourselves all the time. Why aren't people in Europe inventing great companies like with companies we have? You don't see as much in Europe or in other parts of the world as we have been seeing here. Right now, the technology that's dominating the world, certainly outside of China, is American technology. Mm-hmm. Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Facebook, all these companies are American companies. Why aren't we dominated by European technology companies or Middle East technology companies? Because Americans have this innovative style, and we really incent people to do things innovative here.
Wait, I got to follow. So what do you think about what's going on in China right now in terms of really clamping down, it feels like, on the innovators?
Well, in China, I think what's going on is the Chinese government is trying to make it clear to everybody that we, the government, are the most important thing and not the innovators. And so I think there's a concern that sometimes you get entrepreneurs who are worth a lot of money. They're cult figures themselves, Jack Ma and the equivalent, and they kind of rival the government leaders, and the government doesn't think that's appropriate. So the government is doing some things to constrain this. We'll see whether the impact is to have people not be quite as innovative, or whether people will try to take more money offshore, or entrepreneurs will come to this country and not go back to China. You don't know yet.
We're talking, of course, with David Rubenstein. His new book is The American Experiment, also host of Bloomberg Wealth here at Bloomberg Radio and TV, and co-chair, co-founder of the Carlyle Group. But it's interesting, David. Do you think it'll prevent China from being kind of a global presence when it comes to innovative technologies, which is what President Xi has said he wants to be?
It may have some impact. But right now, for example, what is up in the air is who is going to dominate technology around the world over the next 10, 20, 30 years? Is it going to be the American technology companies, or is it going to be the Chinese? Right now, the Chinese technology companies have largely been successful in China. Google and Facebook really don't quite operate in China. They have their own equivalent there. But has China been able to take Alipay, Ant Financial, or Alibaba outside of China that much? Not so much. Or the same with Baidu. Now, the only one that's really become a major force outside of China is ByteDance, which has TikTok, but it doesn't operate at all in China. It really operates outside. But over the next 10, 20 years, 20 or 30 years or so, there'll be an effort by the Chinese to say, let's take our technology companies and use them in Europe, Latin America, the Middle East. And who will dominate? Will we have two internets, or will we just have one internet? And it's unclear. To the extent that we weaken our technology companies in this country, it may be that we won't be dominant around the world as much as we have been. But when you think about it, you go anywhere in the world now, you can use Google, you can use Facebook. You can't go use Baidu or or Alipay anywhere in the world. That may change.
Unless you're in a part of China where one of those services is blocked. David, given what's happened in China over the last few months, would you be hesitant to deploy capital there, to invest there, at least for the near future?
I am an investor in China. I've been a long-term investor there. My firm is an investor there. I personally invested there.
But what about thinking forward over the next few years, given what's happened over the last few months?
There clearly are going to be some constraints on growth and valuation. So, for example, many of the companies that have had some constraints, the Ant Financial transaction is one in where the valuations come down because they're not going to go public quite as quickly as they were going to. I still think, though, you've got a population of 1.3 billion people and a gigantic market, the biggest market in the world. And the country is becoming increasingly wealthy, and therefore people are increasingly spending money. We operate a number of companies there. We operate with our Chinese partners at McDonald's in China. And clearly that's a growing business, doing well. So I wouldn't be hesitant to invest in China. I would just be hesitant to do things that the government isn't going to really like. You got to be very careful and make sure you know what the government will tolerate and not.
The book at the very beginning, you include the preamble to the Constitution. If you could sit down with a forefather today, who would it be? And what would you want to know?
Well, I will answer that in 1 second. I would just say that, interestingly, we had white Christian property owners, men, who were our founding fathers, right? If we had a new Constitution, new Declaration of Independence, who would those people be? Mm. It wouldn't be all white men, right, or property. We'd have presumably women, we'd have minorities. Would we get a different constitution? Would we get a different Declaration of Independence? Probably would. If I could have dinner with any one of those founding fathers, I guess it would be Thomas Jefferson, just because his rhetoric, his writing style is so wonderful. And I'd ask him, how come you never made a speech? As president, you only made one public speech. If you ask Walter Isaacson, he would say he'd like to have, of all the people he's written about, he'd like to have dinner, I think he would say, with Benjamin Franklin, because he's so creative and so right. brilliant in so many ways, uneducated by traditional standards. But now, any of them, I think if I could have dinner with anybody that's ever lived, who's an American, not currently alive, it would be without doubt Abraham Lincoln. In my view, the greatest American of them all, kept the Union together, freed the slaves, though not as quickly as some people would want it. But he was an incredible person, writer, great speaker, and I just like to ask him this, a lot of questions. And it's an interesting phenomenon. You and I are all in the interview business. And this is a business where it's just relatively common now. It's not unique to be an interviewer, right? Lots of people, right. You know, everybody has a podcast. I think there should be a bumper sticker that says, honk if you don't have a podcast. Everybody's got their own podcast. Everybody's got their own TV show. Everybody's got their own radio show. But this is relatively new. For most of organized history, there were no interviews. So we have no interviews of Shakespeare. We have no interviews right. of Cleopatra. We have no interviews of Abraham Lincoln, George Washington. I wish we could go back and interview them. I thought about doing a book interviewing what these people would have said if I'd interviewed them.
That's a great idea.
So I got to say to William Shakespeare, and I will, why do you think it is that people think you didn't write these plays? Or did you really write these plays? Tell us the truth. Or Cleopatra, who was a better lover, Mark Antony or Julius Caesar?
When you land these interviews, let us
or
know.
Both. We'll
play right.
some clips.
Yeah. Or Henry VIII. Why didn't you just get a prenup instead of chopping off the head of your wives? There's a lot of great questions we want to know the answers to.
Well, that's book number four.
Yeah. Right. You did get some fantastic names for this book, you know, including Ken Burns, as we talked right. about, Madeleine Albright, John Meacham, Billie Jean King. Who did you reach out to that you couldn't get?
Who said, I'm sorry, who's this David Rubenstein? I don't have time. Kidding.
No, look, some people do not like to do interviews, and some people are more complicated to get a hold of, and so forth. So I... on this particular book, I have not interviewed, let's put it this way, I have not yet interviewed Elon Musk. I'd like to do that. Walter Isaacson is writing a book about him, and that presumably will be the source of a lot of information.
We saw that on Twitter a few weeks ago, yeah. Elon
yes.
Musk talking about that.
I talked to Walter about it, and he's very happy. He's spending time with him now, and Elon is, I won't give away all the stories.
But it is happening.
It's going to happen, absolutely. And I would say that I'd like to interview, I haven't interviewed Mark Zuckerberg. I'm on a board with him in China. I've been there, went and talked to him a couple of times, but I haven't really interviewed him. I think that'd be interesting. I had a chance to invest in that company when my son-in-law-to-be was at Harvard. He said, invest in this company. I said, it's a dating service, and dating service never get anywhere. That was $13 billion ago.
Ouch. So. Is there a woman that you haven't talked to that you would like to talk to?
Well, Queen Elizabeth doesn't do interviews, so I think that's probably not going to happen. But I would say I have not interviewed Mrs. Obama. Mm-hmm. I've met her many times. I haven't interviewed her. She should be very good as an interviewee. I have interviewed Melinda Gates. I've interviewed many business leaders who are prominent women.
Mackenzie Scott, have you thought about?
I have met her, but I don't have an interview. I haven't actually asked her yet. I think she's relatively shy.
Okay.
And doesn't seek publicity as the way she's doing
it.
If she's watching or listening right now, I'm ready to come out to Seattle tomorrow and do that interview. Because she's doing some really good things in philanthropy.
And really turning the world upside down by doing it fast, doing it very differently than how a lot of other people have done it for a long time.
Yes, and I mean, she's got, I think she was given $34 billion, and now it's probably worth $75 billion, so she's got a lot of money.
Yeah. We have 3 minutes left. Please don't go anywhere. No, just stay forever. The investment environment, I don't know, whether it's SPACs, whether it's crypto, what's interesting to you right now?
Well, clearly crypto is something that gets a lot of attention. It's amazing how many people are interested in crypto related.
Are you invested
things.
In crypto in any way?
I have not invested in crypto currencies myself. I have invested in some companies that kind of service the industry. And my standard view on crypto is when you go to Las Vegas, most people are smart enough to know you're not going to win there. And if you spend more time there, you're certainly not going to win, but you enjoy it. You have the pleasure of gambling. So you pick 1 or 2% of your net worth and do that. Well, the same is true in crypto. Crypto, you want to speculate, you don't really know that much about it, try it 1 or 2 or 3%. It's not harmful, and you'll probably have an enjoyable time, perhaps. I interviewed for my show on Bloomberg, John Paulson recently, mm-hmm. and he is dead set against it. He just said, this is terrible, and it's going to zero. But on the other hand, I've interviewed some other people that'll come out soon who are going to be saying, hey, I think it's a way to make a lot of money. There's one person I'll be interviewing soon who's made billions of dollars in crypto.
Mm-hmm.
What about when it comes to SPACs and where we are in this cycle with SPACs?
SPACs.
Are they here to stay? And look, SPACs aren't anything new.
No.
They're just having a moment right now.
SPACs are not going away, but you have to be wary of what you're doing. You have to know what you're really doing. So SPACs are a way to accelerate an IPO process. And right now, it's harder to raise money for SPACs, and not just the SPAC money. There are two types of money you have to really raise. You raise the initial money for the SPAC, but then you raise money that's called a pre-IPO pipe money, which is the money to help you get public or help the public evaluation stay to what you think it should be. And it's harder to raise that money right now. A lot of somebody is raising, I think it's Apollo, is raising a fund to invest in the SPACs that aren't doing so well and to buy them on the cheap, which is an idea that I think is probably has some merit.
We've already gone to distressed SPACs. 30 seconds left here. What do you think will be the next grand American experiment, just quickly?
Well, the next experiment that I think we'll see, I think probably we're going to see at some point, I hope, greater cooperation between the Republicans and Democratic parties when we have some crisis that really unites them in ways that we haven't really truly been united since 9/11. Now, we're getting ready to celebrate the 20th anniversary of 9/11. We're going to do that at the Kennedy Center. I'm the chairman of the Kennedy Center. We're going to have an event doing that and thanking our military people, but also thanking the healthcare workers who got us through this most recent period of time.
We thank you.
Thank you very
much
for having me.
Thank you so much. David Rubenstein, of course, co-founder, co-chair of the Carlyle Group. His latest book, The American Experiment, Dialogues on a Dream. Do check it out. It's a great still summer. It is still summer, everyone. Still summer read. This is Bloomberg Radio.